This morning's reading is taken from Matthew chapter 8, verses 1 to 17. And you can find that on page 980 of the Church Bibles. Matthew 8, beginning at verse 1. When Jesus came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them. When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. And he said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion replied, Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, Go, and he goes. And to another, Come, and he comes. And to my servant, Do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And to the centurion Jesus said, Go, let it be done for you as you have believed. And the servant was healed at that very moment. And when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. That evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases.
Thank you, Jonathan, for reading for us. May I add my welcome to Leeds. It's very good to see you if you're here for the first time. We're delighted you've been able to join us this morning. I wonder if we might pray together and ask God to speak to us as we listen to his word in the Bible. Let's pray. God says in the Bible, Blessed is the man who meditates on and delights in God's law. So as we think about your word, our Father, we pray that you would bless us. In Jesus' name, amen. Sickness and suffering and global disorder and death are seen in the Bible as clear evidence that all is not well in our world and that our world is under the judgment of God, its creator. The book of Genesis, right at the beginning, describes the pain and frustration of work, the battle of the sexes, the hostility of the environment, the agony of childbirth, and the futility of human life that ends in death as a result of God's just judgment on our rejection of his rule. Jesus, later on in the Bible, describes the warfare of the nations, the earthquake, the famine, as the beginning of the birth pains of God's judgment. Paul describes the groaning and the creaking of our creation as its bondage to decay and judgment. And John, right at the other end of the Bible in the book of Revelation, interestingly describes the four horsemen of the apocalypse, of whom we may have heard, famine, death, warfare and conquest, as being sent out by God in judgment. Now, we need to be very, very clear that sickness and suffering are not by any means always linked directly to something that you and I do wrong. You can't draw a direct link between my wrongdoing and my suffering. Sometimes we can, usually we can't. But the assumption all the way through the Bible is that sickness and suffering and global disorder and death are clear evidence for us that our world is actually under God's judgment, that all is not well. And in this short talk this morning, what I want to urge us to do is to make a wise investment in Jesus in the light of sickness, suffering, disaster and death. Some of us will be all too personally, painfully aware of sickness and suffering and global disorder. I guess it will have touched many of us painfully. There is a tendency, though, for others of us who are not directly affected, I think, in our culture, to shield ourselves from sickness and suffering as we suggest to ourselves somehow that it won't really touch us. So as I was preparing to speak on this passage reasonably recently, I cast my mind to 30 houses, the inhabitants of 12 of which I know reasonably well. A fairly representative cross-section of one part of this city in which we live, middle income, reasonably prosperous. One child, born with numerous medical issues she has battled with all her life. One child with medium-level Asperger's syndrome. One adult with Alzheimer's. Another adult with Parkinson's. Another child with epilepsy, and another family torn apart by a really vitriolic divorce. As I say, I only know the inhabitants of 12 of the houses, of the 30 houses, but at least one in three of us is devastated by sickness, suffering, and disorder. For you and me to try to pretend that all is well with the world is, I think, to live in cloud cuckoo land. I could go to a similar sample in the West Country. Here is the rural idyll to which some in London wish to escape. One child with Down syndrome. One mother knocked down and trodden to death in an appalling farm accident by a prize bull. One family persistently pursued by the black dog of depression. A suicide in the woods with a shotgun, a heroin addict, marriage and divorce, and a mentally handicapped child. Now, I think it's a very interesting thing to see how our culture responds to the sickness, suffering, and death that plagues us all, and to ask the question whether our culture's response actually faces reality. Some, I think, are tempted to adopt the archetypal English pose. We've all met the Stoic, living in denial with his clenched jaw muscles and stiff upper lip. Others simply bury our heads in the sand. It hasn't happened to me yet. I might get lucky if I do the medical insurance and keep up the visits to the gym and keep on taking the herbal remedies. Maybe I'll escape. Others of us simply resign ourselves to it. The fatalists. We're just a random collection of chemicals brought together in a sack of skin by chance. Don't ask why. That's just the way of the world. That's Richard Dawkins, isn't it? DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is. And we dance to its music. Of course, if that is the way of the world, and if we are really only a cocktail of chemicals in a bag of skin, we have no right to cry out against God when something goes wrong. And yet I find that people keep on crying out against God when something goes wrong, as if we know just somehow deep down that it does have at least something to do with him. Others of us engage ourselves, I think, quite heroically and selflessly in managing the sickness, suffering, and disorder, yet with no ultimate hope. Well, the Bible tells us that sickness, suffering, and global disorder and death are clear evidence of God's judgment on the world, and I want to persuade us to invest, at least in investigating Jesus Christ. Humankind, first in Adam and then repeatedly over and again, has engaged in the exercise of pushing God off to the sidelines of our life, seizing the steering wheel. And God's judgment on our act of what you might call rebellion or rejection is plain for everybody to see. Everywhere we look, we see evidences of it. Physical health, human relationships, environment, personal vulnerability to evil, our ultimate death and decay. Let me stress again, you can't draw a direct line between me and my personal rejection of God and me and my personal sickness. But you can't deny that this world in which we live creaks and groans and is riven by deep fissures, the birth pangs of God's judgment. As an 18-year-old, I took a gap year. I mean, many of us did in those days. I don't know if people still do. They're usually too eager to get on with their studies. But as an 18-year-old, I took a gap year, and I went with three friends to Canada on our way. We went to stay with some incredibly wealthy friends of one of the guys in our group. They lived in North America, and it was one of those houses that I guess, you know, when you get into your 60s, you go and visit with your National Trust card. I was put in, maybe you do it when you're younger, but I'm yet to meet anybody. I was put in a bedroom stuffed full of antiques, and there was a large Georgian full-length mirror in one corner, and I'd emptied the pockets of my jeans onto the top of the vast bed, which I slept in a corner of for the night. The next morning, I felt it was probably appropriate in a place like that to make one's bed, although I expect probably there was someone there to do it for you. But in my effort to try and play the part, I took hold of one side of the duvet, as you do, and shook it like that. And I watched in kind of slow-motion horror as a 25-cent piece sped its course across the room to the center of the mirror. There was a sharp crack, and in an instant, radiating out from the center, the whole thing was riven with the fissures. Well, now, this world in which we live, with all its faults, is riven with those kind of fissures. From the initial act of humankind, rebelling against our Creator, who sustains and orders our world, from that initial act, as we humans pushed God off to the side of the sidelines and said, we'll get on living in your world our way, the whole of creation, right the way across. I mean, it has to be, doesn't it? For if God has entrusted this world to us, and if this world only really works when God is overseeing and ruling, then if we've seized the steering wheel and careered off course away from God, we're bound to end up off the rails, if you don't mind me mixing metaphors. The thing I think makes the passage we just had read to us in Matthew chapter 8 and 9 so glorious and so full of hope is that we find there Jesus Christ presented as God's rescuing King. And as he steps onto the pages of history, onto global history, He demonstrates to us ahead of time that here is one who can and will roll back the clouds of God's judgment on our creation. We're just going to look this evening. We've looked all week at the centurion, and we looked last Sunday evening at the leper. This morning, we're just going to look at Peter's mother-in-law, who, like the centurion's servant and the leper before her, makes the point. And she's to be found there in verse 14 in chapter 8 on page 980. And because of the advances in modern medicine, I think we don't take fever nearly as seriously, obviously, as they did back in the first century. Listen to this quote from medical research. "Infectious disease proper was undoubtedly the single greatest threat to life in antiquity, with epidemics killing half or more of the populations of the world's larger cities." Another contemporary quote, "What do the swords of tyrants do? They kill. What does fever do? Nothing else." Well, let's look at verse 14. "When Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick." Striking, isn't it? No consultation, no ambulance, no penicillin, no paracetamol, no convalescence, no outpatient's visit. And the result is that people swarm to him, which is hardly surprising. You know, if it were me, I would be back in R Square, I would be hammering on those doors, and if necessary, I would be dragging people out to come and meet Jesus Christ. Notice from verse 16 there, he healed all who were sick. See, this chapter is intended to show us Jesus Christ, God's rescuing King, that in his coming kingdom, he will roll back the clouds of God's judgment on our creation. And I don't think it's wrong to say that in Galilee, there was a time in the first century when all the hospitals were emptied. There was no sickness. You medics were out of a job as Jesus broke into human history and gave us a snapshot, a window, a foretaste, a picture of his future. I wonder what you make of sickness, suffering, disaster, and death. Some of us just bury our heads in the sand. It's possible to do that, I think, in London. Busy at work, busy at college, busy with the social life, busy paying the mortgage. But then when we next turn on the telly or pick up the paper, it's impossible to deny that all is not well with this world. At that point, I think it's possible just to shrug our shoulders and to resign ourselves. I'm just a bag of chemicals in a sack of skin. I'm only here by chance. I better re-immerse myself in the business of living for now. Eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow, I may be the one in the wheelchair. Others of us are heroically, selflessly managing the decline, but with no ultimate hope for the future. Jesus offers an altogether different alternative. And that's the first reason why I want to encourage us to investigate an investment in Jesus Christ. Because he's demonstrated to us in history, and we can talk about that in the questions, that he is God's rescuing King who can and will roll back the clouds of God's judgment. I wonder whether you ever have actually investigated Jesus. And it's possible to walk through this life with a kind of view of Jesus that was really picked up in one's sort of primary school. I don't think we would base any other area of investment, especially as important as this, with a 7-year-old or 8-year-old or 9-year-old's view of the issue. Well, I want to commend to you perhaps coming and looking at a Christianity Explored course which we run here and investigating the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life for yourself. He opens up an altogether different future that helps us to make sense of this world rather than living with our head in the sand. You may say to me, though, if our world is under God's judgment, how is it that Jesus can one day pull off this reversal, this rescue from decay and judgment that plagues us all? And I don't know if you noticed, the answer is actually there, alluded to in verse 17 of chapter 8. If you have a look down at it, you'll see it now. It's going to involve a certain amount of careful thought, but the answer is there for us. Verse 17 is a quote from the prophet Isaiah. You can see that. And it's Matthew's own translation of a part of Isaiah 53. Just let's have a look at it. This was to fulfill. Now that's referring to everything he's done so far. What was spoken by the prophet Isaiah, he took our illnesses and bore our diseases. Now I think it would pay us to turn back to Isaiah 53. You'll find it on page 700 and something. And I'll give you a more precise reference in just a moment. I think it's 742. 742. I think it's wonderful that we can go back to the Old Testament like this. It shows us that Jesus didn't just come as a kind of flash in the pan. Jesus didn't just kind of emerge on the pages of history like that, out of the blue. There were centuries of expectation for his arrival. I think it gives huge integrity to the Christian faith that it's tied in, woven in, if you like, to the great history of humanity. Here we are. I hope that was giving you time to find the page. Now, the prophecy of Isaiah comes broadly in three parts. Part one is about the promise of a kingly presence, Emmanuel, God with us. Part three is about God victorious, the mighty anointed conqueror king. I have to say to you that given that our chapter, Matthew 8, is all about God's rescuing king who delivers from judgment, I would expect Matthew to refer us either to part 1 of Isaiah or to part 3, which is all about the mighty, conquering, rescuing king. If you were writing this, I think you and I, that'd be the most obvious place to go. The central part of Isaiah is all about a figure known as the suffering servant, who in his kingly suffering carries in his own body God's judgment at our human rebellion. And that's where Matthew points us. I wonder if you can see what he's doing. Not only is Jesus the rescuing king who will roll back God's judgment, Jesus is the suffering servant who carries God's judgment in his own body. Well, let's have a look now at the prophecy in more detail. I wanted just to look at verses 4 to 6. Surely he's borne our grief and carried our sorrows. You esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. That's where Matthew translates and gives us his version of that verse. Now look at verse 5. But he, that's the suffering servant, was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes, we are healed. Transgression. Well, transgression is the willful act of rebellion. I don't know if you're the kind of person that sings in the shower. If you are, you will have sung, I'll do it, or I did it my way. Frank Sinatra's great song. Well, great tune, wretched words. Transgression is me living out my life on the centre of the pitch, if you like, with God shoved off to the sidelines, saying, I'll do it my way. Iniquity is falling short of God's right and perfect standards, and unless we're unbearably, smugly self-righteous, we will be deeply conscious of having fallen short of God's standards. As we look at the verse, you can see that this suffering servant willingly takes on himself God's judgment at our transgression. Just look at it. He was wounded for our rebellion. He was crushed for our failure. Upon him was the punishment that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. Now, do you see, this is an exact remedy as God the Son satisfies the just judgment of God the Father at our rejection of God. And it's spelt out for us in words of one syllable then in verse 6. All we like sheep have turned, gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord, that is God the Father in heaven, has laid on him, that is Jesus Christ, the suffering servant, the iniquity of us all. Well, now, we'll keep that open for a moment, but do you see what Matthew is doing? He's bringing together the idea of Jesus, the conquering king, who will roll back God's judgment and present us with his glorious future, free from everything that spoils and wrecks our world. Together with the idea of Jesus, the suffering servant, who rolls back God's judgment by bearing God's judgment in his own body on the tree, on the cross. And I want us to think about this for a moment. See, all of us, I think, long for a day when sin and suffering are done with, and sickness and so on. And that's what Give Peace a Chance is all about, isn't it? That's what Feed the World, or World Poverty Day, or UNICEF, that's what it's all about. We sometimes see it suggested to us as a kind of glorious dream that we might hope for. I think we see it in The Lion King, if you remember it, when Scar rules the kingdom, the hyenas take over, the kingdom is decimated, they ravage the population, the vegetation dies, and Walt Disney presents us with a picture of our world, with its broken fissures running through it. And then Simba, the hero, in case you haven't seen The Lion King, returns. Here is the rescuing king and ruler. But how is the damage and destruction that has flowed put right? It rains. I think that's basically it. A bit of water. Wash away the stains. And the Hollywood choirs then sing The Circle of Life. Now, even my 10-year-old can see that this is one of the cheesiest moments in the whole of Hollywood's sentimental history. How can a bit of water cleanse away the indelible damage and debt that has flown from the wickedness of our rebellion against our Creator? How can that be right? What would you make of a judge who said to a rape victim, "Oh, just have a shower, dear. Wash it away." Now, if God knows any moral purity, if there is within the character of God anything that's right and just, he must express his judgment, mustn't he, at our willful rebellion. And the glorious truth of the suffering servant and of Jesus on the cross is that God's just judgment is expressed by God the Father towards the willing, obedient, perfect, suffering Jesus. Now, I want to suggest that gives us another good reason for investing in Jesus Christ. Not only is the future secure, justly and rightly secure, but also in the present, as we experience suffering and sickness, which all of us will, and death, we have access to the God who knows what it is to suffer. And we have access to the God who has opened the gateway back into his presence so that as we suffer, we can experience the presence of God and the care of God and the love of God. This is no sentimental Walt Disney whitewash. This is God the Son satisfying the right indignation of God the Father willingly, obediently, so that he can roll back the clouds of God's judgment. Well, my aim this morning is to persuade us to invest in Jesus. I hope we've got two clear reasons there. One, because the rescuing King Jesus rolls back the clouds of God's judgment. There is a perfect future free from God's judgment. Two, this Jesus has secured a perfect future. By carrying God's judgment, he secures a present relationship. So that in the present, as we suffer and experience these things, we can know God with us. Well, Lee, what are we going to do? Are we going to sing now, or are we going to go straight into questions? I'll hand over to you. I think you know what's going on, so I shall hand over to you.
We're not going to sing now. We're going to have a break now for about 15 minutes. Come together under the same sort of category, so we're hoping to answer those together. First, there are a couple of interesting ones here. Did you own up to breaking the mirror, or did you just leave it?
I did own up, and interestingly, it's typical of that sort of place. Oh, really, it doesn't matter at all. You know, as if we've got 15 others. You know, they didn't blink an eyelid. No doubt when I'd gone, it was a different story, but, you know, it was as if, you know, I've got 400 of those stacked away in a back room. It was very funny.
Another one here. What is a fissure? Is it something to do with Jesus making us fishers of men?
A fissure is a crack, isn't it? You see it in the pitch on the fifth day of a test match, hopefully, if England are trying to bowl out the opposition.
Here's a slightly more serious one. How can we be persuaded that Matthew gives us an accurate account of Jesus' life and miracles?
Yes. I've tried to answer this on several occasions through this week in the evening, and you might like to listen online or get a disc or something of that talk where I've tried to answer it several times. The historicity of the accounts of Jesus was a matter of very, very great importance in the first century. And it was of very great importance to Jesus. And he appointed 12 and trained them carefully so that they would record and give an accurate account of his life. They're known as apostles. They're named in the Gospels. And I think it's worth recognizing that those 12 apostles were self-consciously writing history, not myth. So they were very deliberate about that. And if you read the beginning of Luke's gospel, if you've got a chance, just those first four verses make it very plain that Luke thinks he's writing history. He was a doctor, a professional man. And all the way through the gospel accounts, you find the gospel accounts running right through them, incidents that tie us in to the contemporary history of the day, which you can verify by just looking at your history books. Added to that, the gospel writers taught an ethic, that's a way of living, of total integrity. It seems to me that if they built their whole thing on a lie, when they themselves argue for total integrity and a self-conscious lie, then, you're beginning to say, well, hold on, could they really have done this, knowing that, in addition to which, they were prepared to go to their death for what they wrote, most of them. Now, I know martyrdom doesn't necessarily make a thing right, but the fact that so many of them, and while they wrote, there were living witnesses, who were very able to say, hang on, this is not what actually happened. Not many people know this. There was an editorial process going on with regard to the New Testament, even as the New Testament writers wrote. So you can find documents that were excluded because they didn't actually tie up with what the apostles taught. So everything we got in the New Testament, the grounds on which it was included at the time was that it was from an apostle. The last way there are lots more to say. That Christianity Explored, there's a table over there telling you all about Christianity Explored. You have all the time in the world to begin to look at the New Testament documents on Christianity Explored, and it is really worth doing. Charlie, who runs it, is an Oxford historian, so he'll be able to help you. But I would want to say, in addition, read the New Testament. In a sense, I think it's unfair to ask of God that one has an authority above the New Testament, if you like, to verify the New Testament. Because if God is God, how can you have an authority bigger than God to justify or to verify what God's saying? Actually, when you pause and think about it, it is a logical absurdity. And therefore, I would encourage you to read the New Testament. As you do so, I think you will find that it speaks for itself. Notwithstanding, there are plenty of other kind of ways in that show us the historicity of the New Testament.
Great. Okay. Here's another one on a slightly different ground, and that's, is God just playing with us, i.e. allowing suffering is just a way of making himself look good?
Yes. Absolutely not. God's judgment is an awful thing and an appalling thing, and so awful, ultimately, the prospect of being cut off from God for eternity, that God is prepared to send his own son to his death on a cross. Now, God wouldn't do that if it was all just a big game. So, absolutely not. But when you pause and contemplate the character of God, if God is to have any justice, which is a beautiful thing, within his character, he must deal with our rejection of him. If he doesn't, then what kind of God is he? If he just says, oh, well, never mind. You know, they do go on, don't they? As we reject him and push him to the side and get on with living our life without recognition. If there's any justice in God's character, he must judge. So, and suffering and sickness are identified by Jesus as the birth pangs, which some of you will know more about than I, of God's judgment. The birth pangs. They're just a foretaste of the reality of the horror of being shut out from God forever, for which Jesus died.
Well, here's a question on the birth pangs. When faced with sickness or death or any adversity, we always ask the question, why? How do we answer that question? If God is such a righteous God, why does he allow this kind of suffering to
come? Well, I mean, I've tackled this from an angle which I don't think we hear very often. Why does God allow in inverted commas, allows, because it's part of his judgment. Interestingly, in the Bible, the very first thing human beings do when they rebel against God is first to hide, head in the sand, second to blame God. Well, second to blame each other, third to blame God. And God is insistent that we are morally responsible individuals. He has a very high view of us. He sees us as morally responsible, and therefore he insists that judgment must be a reality. So that's why he allows. In some ways, last point on this, I think his judgment, if he were to allow us to kind of truck along forever in a state of rebellion against him, I think it would be an awful thing when you stop and think about it. Okay, enough on that one.
If we're no more than a sack of chemicals in a skin, which is a great phrase, are you saying there is no point in living in a civilized way? Are there no values if God doesn't exist?
All values are relative if God doesn't exist. And if you come from a culture like the Carthaginians did, that believe in child sacrifice, then ultimately, who are we at the end of the day to say it's wrong? Ultimately, if the whole culture agrees that that's the right thing to do. If there is no God out there, then it's left to us. And I think this is one of the strong, a number of sort of philosophical answers as to why we sort of have to come to a conclusion that God does exist, because we do believe, actually, that certain things are wrong. Was it Dostoevsky who said, if God is dead, might is right? If God is dead, might is right. Because ultimately, we're left to make up those decisions about what is right and what is wrong ourselves. And you will know that through democratic means, sometimes, cultures have come up with things which you and I say, that has to be wrong. Why do you say it has to be wrong if the culture decided it was right? Especially if the culture was equally as developed and civilized as we are. On what grounds do you say it's wrong that the Aztecs tore hearts out of other human beings and presented them as sacrifices? They all thought it was right. Well, you've got no grounds to say that. Apart from, oh, well, we're far more civilized than they are. But what happens if a more civilized society than us comes along and says, I don't know, killing old people is right? Well, are you going to say that's wrong? How, on what grounds? See, Dostoevsky is very shrewd. If you read either The Idiot or... what is the other one? Absolutely brilliant, the opening chapters. Someone will tell me afterwards, I can't remember. Go and read some Dostoevsky. He points it out.
There are so many good Dostoevsky novels that we've all read, we just can't think of which one it is. Here's on a slightly different track. Why did Jesus want to die for me? Why that kind of suffering death for me? Why do we want to do that?
Thank you very much. Running right the way through the Bible is the intense love of God as a fundamental aspect of his nature and character. So I just jotted down a few references as I was thinking about this upstairs. You know, Exodus 34, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping his steadfast love for 1,000 generations. Now we see that steadfast love emerge on the kind of in technicolor in the person of Jesus. Later on in Matthew, Jesus looked out on the crowd, just next chapter, Matthew chapter 9, Jesus looked out on the crowd and saw them, harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd, and he had compassion on them. That's the steadfast love of God. John chapter 3, verse 16, God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish or might not perish, but have love. 1 John 4, this is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us and gave his Son as a sacrifice for our sin. Romans 8, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So why would Jesus want to die for me? Because he loves you, and he doesn't want you to go to an eternity of regret and anguish at having lived out a life under God's in rebellion against God. That's why he died for you, to stop you going to hell. Yeah. And hell has to be a reality if God knows any justice. If God knows any justice, hell has to be a reality.
Here's one sort of following up on that that side of things. I know that I'm not worthy to have God come under my roof, sort of echoing the centurion in the reading. Am I not a hypocrite for asking God to forgive me every week after I have yet again let him down and sinned? Quite a poignant one there.
Yes, thank you very much. The wonderful picture of... one of the great pictures of forgiveness is being brought into the family of God. And once we're in the family, though we don't always behave as a family member, we bear the family name. And all of us go on in this world where we still live with, our sort of inner self that keeps on rejecting God, all of us as Christians go on behaving as if we're not family members. And please don't hear me saying that I think Christians are necessarily somehow kind of better people. No. But once we're in the family, then I jotted down Psalm 103, as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. And God knows what we're like, and the death of Jesus on the cross pays for our ongoing rebellion against him. I don't know if you know that there's a word in a verse in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. Christ died for sins once for all. Now, that once for all does not mean once for everybody. It means once for all time. Once for all time. It was a one-off, sufficient sacrifice for our rebellion. So, yes, we're still human. Yet we go on rejecting God. We're in the family, and the once-for-all-time sacrifice of Jesus on the cross has covered us. And again, in Romans, Paul talks beautifully of standing in a position of grace. Not hopping in and out of a position of grace, but standing as if we're in the inner court, forgiven. Am I still a hypocrite? No, God knows what we're like. I think that's enough.
We've got time for a couple more quick ones. Carefully phrased, would you like to comment on Tony Blair's involvement of prayer and God in his decision to declare war on Iraq? Would you like to comment?
Not really.
I thought you might say that.
I mean, Tony Blair, as a Christian, is right to recognise that he has a responsibility in God's world as a person put in government towards his maker. And he is right to recognise that he is answerable to God. And if he calls himself Christian, not to have prayed before he makes a decision like that would have been quite bizarre. No, it's a recognition, I take it, that he will face God in judgment, as we all will.
Good. And just one final question then. What persuaded you personally that Jesus was worth investing in? This is your last question.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, it is almost impossible in 2 minutes to answer that. I think evidentially you look at the person of Jesus and you have to say, well, look, either he's a complete lunatic because of the claims he makes, or he is who he says he is. And I think as I've read the New Testament over and over again, you know, I sometimes have doubts, you know, am I doing the right thing? But as I come back to the New Testament over and over again, you find actually it stacks up, and he is the most, if he isn't God, he's a nutter. And when you look at the person of God expressed in the face of Jesus Christ, he is the most beautiful person, and that he should die for me. Not to follow him, I think, would be an absurdity. I was brought up in a nominal Christian... I was brought up in a Christian home with a kind of distant belief in God. And it was when I came face to face with Jesus Christ, introduced by, you know, actually it was my grandfather, but looking and started to look at Jesus in the New Testament, that I began to say, if this is God's world, if I'm God's creature, and if God in his goodness and kindness has died for me to bring me back into a relationship with him, not to take him up on that, it would be, I think, the ultimate kind of offence to God to say, oh, well, it means nothing to me.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, William. You may have other questions that you'd like to have answered. William's going to be around for a bit longer, so you can come up to the front afterwards and grill him even further. If you don't think I've done quite as good a job as Michael Parkinson would have done in this situation. There's more coffee, particularly served over to my right there. There may even be some more of those lovely chocolate cookies left, if you'd like to grab one of those. There are some books and CDs available underneath the gallery over here to my left. The CDs are entirely free if you're a visitor, a guest here today. Church family can pay up as usual. There are also some books. If you're visiting us today and you came with somebody, why not get them to buy you a book? Lots of great books there underneath the gallery which look, go into these sort of subjects of Christianity a little bit in more depth. Two other things. You'll find on the back of your service sheet for today an advert for the Christianity Explored course.